Well, my name is Stuart Fink.
And I'm Glenn Jacob.
And the story today is called The Purple Piano Woolamazoo by Glenn Jacob.
Around 50 years ago, give or take four, there were two churches on an edge of town street. They were right next door. The folks who attended them on this church that was hilly thought the next door church was odd, in fact, quite silly.
There was the Church of the Red and the Church of the Blue. In the one on the left, the Church of the Red, they lit red candles and sang hymns like the Saga of Zed. In the one on the right, the Church of the Blue, they rang blue bells and danced in the circle of Lula Kamu.
After their service, as they went down the street, they avoided folks from their neighbor church. Those weren't folks that they wanted to meet. What they do there is too weird and too odd. Don't say hello. Don't even nod. Their clothes, their bells and their hymns, their dances and songs, even the clothes they wear are so different and so wrong.
One fine day, the people from Blue decided to clean up the park down by Lake Simba Timtu. It was full of litter and discarded trash. It was so dirty, the kids who played there were getting a rash. But lo and behold, as they started to clean, they saw a group from Church Red already on the scene. They were bagging and sweeping and cleaning up goo. The ones from Church Blue were so shocked, they didn't know what to do.
Some wanted to turn away and walk, but there were a couple of brave ones who joined in and started to talk. They learned the people from Red cared about things too. They wanted the parks to be cleaner and the earth to be greener. They all wanted peace. They all hated war. They wanted fighting to stop and violence no more. They loved freedom of choice. They loved being involved. They loved social equality and seeing problems solved.
The folks from Red and Blue were now having fun. They introduced topics and agreed on almost every one. They talked about politics and the economy and stuff they agreed on how Fluffy should be the Huffle Fluff Puff. It turns out the ceremonies we do and the songs that we sing don't define what a church is. It's the work that we do and the love that we bring. You could have candles and dance. You could have artwork or plants. You could have coffee and cake or that jello you make. If you make it with care and you serve it up neat, you will have a church that can't be beat.
So some time went by, and the two became friends. For all those past sneers and snickers, they all made amends. They did things together. They had dances and fun. And after a while, the two churches became one. Now there is one big church on that street, one building combined. A large congregation, happy and well. All kinds of folks might light a candle or ring a bell. They no longer wear all red or all blue, but they still sing the Saga of Zed and dance the Lula Kamu.
And they have a new instrument, and they love it through and through. They play it for hymns and at coffee time, too. For new songs and new dance, things got much better when they all took a chance. When they looked past differences so tiny and realized that they were all being quite whiny. They put their hearts together, and oh, the things they will do. For now their church is called the Purple Piano Woolamazoo. The end.
I'm going to speak a little bit this morning. The topic is turning the swords into plowshares. For those of you who are not aware, it is a biblical reference about turning war into peace activities. The world is a very scary place, and I think we can all agree on that. There are just too many people out there who don't value other people's lives. There's killing and maiming by terrorists, shooting innocent children at schools or people at work sites, other public places, and hurting each other in so many terrible ways around the world. When I wrote this, which unfortunately was a couple of months ago and so little has changed, right-wing politicians and candidates were using fear triggered by terrorist attacks in Paris and in San Bernardino to advocate the persecution of an entire group of people based on their religion. These people, and I think we all know who they are, were shockingly taking public positions that people who had this religious belief or were from this particular country should not be allowed into our country, or if they were already here, should be publicly branded, perhaps by keeping information on them in a database. And any of us who've studied World War II were just terrified at the thought of this. As this entire religion was painted with the brush of a few who used a person's identification with their religion to terrorize and kill innocents around the world, other people were in fear and seemed to be more than willing to give up their own and others' rights and freedoms. Racist and discriminatory speech, which at least when I was a child, people tried to at least keep it home where it wasn't quite so public, was being trumpeted from stadiums all over the country in front of large groups of thousands of people, and people were applauding. And it seemed, and often does seem still, that the voices of those who would stop these injustices were not heard. Even those who denounced this or said, tried to remind us of what had happened historically, their voices were swallowed up in hate. How do we stop this when voices against that promote civility and a common humanity are so, you know, so quiet in comparison, so often not heard against the demagogues? How can you use make a difference when we are members of such a small church? This is an even tinier percentage of the population. How do we find allies in this work? One place that I in particular would advocate for is that we work with those who for religious reasons believe we need to care for the poor and the needy and the afflicted. Groups whose professed creed have such doctrines are actually quite large and influential in the United States. Of course, we all know many people who follow a religious teaching whose leader promoted love, and in fact the followers can be hateful and hurtful, but not everyone should be labeled with these same ideas and brushes. There are voices with whom we can merge our own cause to make a deeper meaning and change in American life and culture, and we would be well served by finding them and working together with them. So from that statement, I think many of you know that Scott and I were raised Seventh-day Adventist, which is a religious tradition of presidential candidate Ben Carson, who is not notorious for his liberal nor reasoned beliefs. Seventh-day Adventists are one of at least three pretty conservative religious traditions, Christian traditions, that began in the United States in the 1800s during the period called the New Awakening. All three have historically been extremely conservative and had an ethos for sending out missionaries to the world for proselytizing. Many people confuse the three, but I can assure you, having been raised as one, they're not the same, and they don't appreciate being confused any more than an Irishman likes to be called English. So, just to give you my very brief childhood differentiation, and it's not theologically correct, but I always called SDAs Christian Jews because we follow the Jewish Sabbath in the Old Testament pretty much exclusively, didn't eat unclean meat, we had a female prophet, and Seventh-day Adventists have a very strong medical and educational bent with the second largest private hospital and educational system in the United States. And I differentiated Mormons, although they also avoided tobacco, alcohol, and caffeine, but they went to church on Sunday, had a male prophet, and tended to have larger families. And then as a child, I knew the Jehovah's Witnesses were the ones who didn't believe in blood transfusions or repeat in the Pledge of Allegiance. And I used to get angry when people would say, well, you don't believe in a blood transfusion. No, that's a Jehovah's Witness. So while the belief of these fairly conservative churches have typically been outside of the mainstream of the U.S., they are a lot larger than you would think. I was doing some research and I found that there are 69 million Americans who are Roman Catholic and 5 to 8 million who are Jews, depending on how you define Jewishness. It's a rather loose topic, and about 3 million are Muslim. SDA's Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses each have between 15 and 18 million, compared to the 200 to 800,000 you used. So these conservative religious groups have a very large population, and they are growing because they are strong proselytizers. And at least when I was a child, the patterns of life in these strict fundamentalist churches were very rigid and very exclusionary. It seemed that the church was designed to keep us from interacting with others in the wise society and the dialogue. There are behavioral controls that forbade dancing and going to movies and playing cards. And we had separate churches and schools and social systems. And I really personally didn't even impact this outside social world of the 60s and 70s until I was a teenager. So that's my part of the reason I don't know who the Grateful Dead were very well. My reading material was religious and pretty much only the Bible on Sabbath, and most of us were only allowed to listen to classical or religious music, except in my household, but we were allowed to listen to Johnny Cash and Bluegrass because my dad liked them. But at least in the 60s and 70s, television was widely denounced as an evil demon, and most of them very rarely watched television. But, you know, with my cohort in crime and social activities enabler right over there, I learned to dance, attend movies, and, you know, started wearing jewelry and everything before we left the church in the 20s. But then all four of my siblings also left the SDA church. Many of our friends did as well and went on to various personal journeys ranging from atheism, paganism, to some sort of virulent unchurch status. But a couple kept in touch with everyone that we knew. And as Facebook became popular and then my siblings, I became reacquainted with these childhood friends, and I found that many of these people who were raised so conservatively were engaged in a very deep spiritual discussion and journey together. And at first, when I was getting reacquainted with them and talking on Facebook, we began talking what I call the mother tongue of our SDAism, because quite frankly, no one here besides Scott and Amy would discuss with me our great love for haystacks and whether or not it's better to have Doritos or Fritos, and how horrible putting rubber cheese on it, or what is the difference between a Loma Linda Frank and a Worthington Vegemite. Really, you know. So, but it is true that whether your mother language is Russian, Mandarin, Spanish, or SDAism, there's really something quite healing to go back and to discuss these things with someone in your mother tongue. But I began to realize that these childhood friends of mine, who I still thought of in this quite narrow box, were engaged in some pretty dynamic social changes. And the first piece happened when my sister posted this piece about a friend of ours who's a biology teacher at a Seventh-day Adventist college not far from here. And Scott and I have known him since we were teenagers. And we found that many in the church and colleges around the country and around the world were trying to get him fired, because in one biology class, he had dared to say that mutations and environmental factors change species. And this happens to bacteria and viruses and reptiles and birds and mammals. You cannot imagine the intensity of the debate about whether he was teaching evolution and whether he should get fired as a college biology professor. He actually survived because tenure, even in religious colleges, is a force of nature. But over the next several years, I began to read more and more of his posts and his blogs, and then a widening web of interconnection with people that I had known or who knew our friends. And I found that the fundamentalist religion of my childhood, which I still thought of as this very rigid box, was really in a civil war. The first camp comes from the former missionary regions of the world, but some in Europe and North America, and quite frankly, sorry, but those born before 1960. And the second side was more socially liberal, mostly younger, and I say that in quotes because I realize many of us aren't that young anymore, well-educated and from North America. This socially liberal group in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and I found in other conservative churches, is fighting very hard for causes they believe that Jesus Christ supported. Equality between the genders, including ordination of women, which is still a huge battle in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, the ability of gay members to be accepted, the right to come to their beliefs from a more rational and scientific point of view, but most importantly, to express what they believe and see Jesus Christ as having done and taking care of the poor and needy by providing homes for the homeless, living wages, and health care for those who need it. So in these posts, that I would see from them on Facebook, there would be such things as, I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was in prison and you visited me. The intensity of what they were saying and how I responded to it was astonishing. Have you ever been in a non-English-speaking country for a few weeks without a guide and tried to get along with your basic skills of whatever language it is and the few people there who speak English, and you had gotten to the point where you were so exhausted with attempts to speak a language in basically the level of a three-year-old, and then you suddenly came upon a group of people speaking English. And the sense of relief is enormous, because you can speak an adult, nuanced language without saying, where bathroom, what lunches. And I know, I recall clearly when we had been living in Germany for a couple of years, courtesy of that tour guide, the U.S. Air Force, and had only been listening to the one Armed Forces network. This was pre-Spotify or Pandora or anything, and the German stations, and we went to England, we turned on the television, and we found multiple channels with people speaking in some sort of English. And we came to tears. It was overwhelming. This is exactly the same feeling that I had when I started going on Facebook and other social media blogs. And I saw things of what, in my native religious tongue, speaking to me about what is important to me, caring for the fortunate and not trying to force people to change. These people, these friends of mine, were fiery social changers. But they were using the language of the Bible, which I know, and the conservative Christian, which I speak, to assert these socially liberal points of view. Concept that had been difficult sometimes to articulate here at church became a much more powerful force for me, because I was no longer translating them in my head, just like I do when I'm in Germany or when I'm in Mexico speaking in German instead of Spanish. It was the same kind of thing. This whole internal conflict really came to a head to me actually on right after the attacks in November 13 in Paris. I was listening to things on KQED and other radio stations and people at work and how people were viewing what had happened and equating refugees with ISIS terrorists and saying we shouldn't let anyone into our country from Syria because they might be a terrorist. And I was very emotional about all of this. And it really came to a head for me when I saw in the post of a friend of mine who's a liberal Seventh-day Adventist, and it spoke to me, but actually I don't think really why the author intended it, but it was a visceral understanding of why we sometimes cannot bridge the difference between us and others who share some similar social beliefs. This post was a graphic of a traditional painting by John Martin, and it's called The Destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. You may not know it, but you may have seen it. It shows a family running away from the cities that are burning. And for those of you who don't know the story, it's widely used in conservative Christian churches, and it's from the Old Testament, and it's Lot's family was forced to leave the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah that were burned, and they were spared because his uncle Abraham was beloved by God and he'd asked a favor. Now, as often preached from the pulpits, and I've heard hundreds of times, that the cities were burned because the people had, for the wages of sin, and they had somewhat lax sexual standards. However, this friend of ours, who is a fairly, has some liberal beliefs, had this painting, which is indelibly in my brain, and he quoted something from Ezekiel, which is a prophet in the Old Testament, explaining why Sodom was burned. And this quote says, "Now this was the sin of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters were arrogant, overfed, and unconcerned. They did not help the poor and needy. They were haughty and did detestable things. Therefore I did away with them." Under this graphic, the author just left a bare commentary about treating Syrian refugees. But the hot debate going on in his blog had some further understanding about the what Bible and what Christians are directed to do and how Christians should be viewed in the media. But it crystallized to me four things. One is that this is an accurate quote from the Bible, and all the people who were Seventh-day Adventists or raised Seventh-day Adventists, and they knew that. Nobody knew the painting. The second was that the author had completely, utterly, devastatingly destroyed a cherished conservative meme about how we should live our lives. And the third was that this Old Testament prophet was saying that it is those who do not take care of the poor and needy who should be looked at, you know, as askance, not how we live our personal lives. And it was such a devastating bit of commentary cutting to the part of what it means to be a person who follows moral guidance from the Bible. And everybody on the blog, whether they agreed with him or not, was completely aware of how devastating it was. So I thought about reposting this graphic on my Facebook page, and I realized that except for Scott and my sisters and brother and maybe a couple of childhood friends, nobody would get it. They would think that it was kind of distracting. This conundrum has haunted me since, because the news media has continues to have stories about how Americans think we shouldn't bring refugees to the United States, or, you know, there are stories endlessly about gun violence by those with and without police badges, and then there's stories about people who are homeless in the Bay Area or where, you know, people can live. And I think, why can't we work together with other people who share beliefs about these social issues and try to make things better locally, regionally, and perhaps in the world? And for me, I think one reason we can't comes from my own story, is that this graphic, which was so effective for me in providing a moral guidance and understanding of what we should do in the world, doesn't make sense to a lot of people who are on the secular humanist side. And I know that many people who have religious beliefs have talked to me, and when they know what church I go to, and they've said, I've talked to a secular humanist, and they've told me things like, well, it's just stupid to believe in religion, or anyone who believes in X is obviously too stupid to discuss anything with, or people who believe in X have nothing to rational to add to the debate. And I've heard similar things to this too. And so I've come to believe that this difference in cultural stories and basic language is one of the major things that keeps us from uniting with others to have a more effective force for social change. It's like that old parable with the blind men who are all standing around the elephant and they each are touching a different part and they think that they're in a different reality. And so each of us is touching the elephant of social change and thinking that we're in a different universe. Seeing the world from dissimilar perspectives, we can be led to accept that adage that those who believe differently from us are wrong. We forget that, as C.S. Lewis said, who's the author of the Narnia Chronicles and a lot of Christian writing, what you see and hear depends a good deal on where you're standing. Many people in UU congregations have gone through a sense of personal growth and change that has led us to a more expanded and often more secular view of ethics and morality. But it is important to remember that there are a lot of other people who have also gone through a series of change and understanding about the world, but that their worldview is still steeped in religion and belief, and it is hurtful to people to assume that they are not, you know, they haven't reached as intelligent or they're too different from us. It's important that we try to remember that if a house is divided against itself, it cannot stand. So how do we bridge this canyon? How do we reach our allies to work together toward a common goal of a peaceful world where people's basic needs are maintained? And how do we do this without hurting other people's feelings? I have a few suggestions that have worked for me and continue to work for me. They may not work for you, but perhaps you will find them as a springboard. First, I think is an important thing to remember. This is often said to me when I was a child: when you are arguing with a fool, make sure he isn't doing the same thing. Or as perhaps more eloquently said by theologian Paul Tillich, the first duty is to listen. So when we do converse with others, it's important to not brush off their statements as wrong. The sense of superiority is easily heard in language. And I had a customer service training many years ago, and the professor said that any time you speak with someone and they hear at the end of your sentence, "you idiot," they will tell. I mean, because your tone of voice, your body language, people will hear that "you idiot." And then quickly the conversation will descend in some sort of negative, you know, a fight where no one wins. And when the battle is complete, you may think, "oh, I've won up the other one," but you've really lost, because you will never, ever get someone to agree with you if they are angry and on the defensive and have heard you in their mind saying "you idiot." And if you've been on the phone with a customer service person, you know there are many times that's just hurt. So the second thing to keep in mind is we should not assume that if someone is to be an ally on a typical topic that we might want, like in the community, that housing for the homeless or minimum wage or something, that we shouldn't assume that these people should have the same point of view on us as all topics. Because as Jonathan Anthony Burkett said, "you know my name, not my story. You've heard what I've done, but not what I've been through. Stop judging me." So everyone has a different story. We have different beginnings, different paths, different endings, and we're not all at the same place. And you can't assume that everyone is on the same place as you on every topic. So if you set that aside, there are some people that are just too painful to work with, but if you can at least leave them with a positive memory of you, perhaps in the future you can work with that person. And then third, when you're speaking with someone who has a different mother tongue, it's helpful to know a few words of that language. And it's the same with religious mother tongues. Studying the sacred words and basic stories that underlie the beliefs of major religions is actually not that difficult. You can get to the level of the pidgin French you would use on a trip to Paris fairly easily. There are many books and podcasts and books on CD, even some of the UUA, that can be very helpful in learning some of that basic language. And I have found, for instance, in my commute that listening to Jack Kornfield talk about Buddhism is not only helpful in working with some of my Buddhist coworkers, but it's helpful on my commute as well. So it can help in all aspects of life. And finally, try to find ways to interact with people who have a different view of the world, perhaps from a religious perspective. And one of the ways that we have been doing this in the church is through the interfaith community. And we have a speaker coming next week who is Muslim, and we'll be talking about that. And that's a very helpful way. You can also go to community meetings or festivals in the summer. The Coptic Church in Hayward, the Greek Orthodox Church in Castro Valley have events where you can go and you can speak with the leadership there at the church and find out about their beliefs, volunteering with group agencies like FESCO or South Hayward Parish, which we're involved in. There will be many people in those organizations who have religious beliefs but yet share many of the same social concerns that we have. It's always important to get to know people in their settings, and it will pay off. It will help you get an understanding how they live and find an ally in the world. So be the change you wish to see in the world. Reach out across the spaces that divide us and work toward the common goals that we have to improve how we all live. Together we can meet the physical needs for the poor. We can work to achieve peace and love for others in our community, in the region, and the world. We can reduce the chasm that divides us by first working on ourselves to become more welcoming and understanding those who have maybe share some of the same goals but express them differently or come from a different perspective. Then we can expand from these individuals outward to join forces to reduce poverty and hate and make the world a better place, and turn our swords into plowshares. Blessed be.